From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today is the one-week anniversary of the London bombings. 3 days after the London bombings, almost the exact same number of people died in Iraq. Where was the media coverage and the outrage about that?
As more people die each day in Iraq, we look at Iraqi hospitals ailing under occupation. We'll speak with independent journalist Dar Jamal. Then a debate on immigration will go to Arizona, where people continue to die in the heat of the summer.
What's happening right now down there is really the result of a failed policy that everyone, whether they're on the right or the left, agrees is really an atrocity. People are dying in the desert. Thousands of people are being forced every year to walk through a desert to get jobs that America, the American president and the Mexican president say should be given to Mexican migrant labor. So we're going to have to decide as a country over the coming months what we're going to do about that.
And 20 years after the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior, we'll look at how the French president, François Mitterrand, personally approved the attack on the Greenpeace ship. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today in Britain, memorials are being held to mark the one-week anniversary of the coordinated bomb attacks that killed more than 50 people and wounded more than 700. Among the events, 2 minutes of silence that was observed across the European Union. Late Wednesday, Scotland Yard continued its raids, searching another house northwest of London, but no arrests were reported. News reports have identified 3 British men of Pakistani descent as suspects in the bomb attacks. Britain's Press Association, citing police sources, said police had identified a 4th suspect, but no name or details were reported. Meanwhile, British police have identified a British-born man who they say masterminded last week's attacks. According to the London Times, the man is believed to be in his 30s and of Pakistani origin. The paper says he arrived at a British port last month and is understood to have left the country the day before the bombings that killed at least 52 people. Meanwhile, the New York Times is quoting an unnamed U.S. official as saying the man is a British citizen. The paper says that while he is not Anglo, said the American official, he is not of Pakistani descent. On Wednesday, several U.S. law enforcement officials identified one of the suspected bombers as a Jamaican-born British resident named Lindsay Germain. The other suspected bombers were of Pakistani descent and lived in working-class neighborhoods of Leeds. Back in this country, President Bush said Wednesday he will not comment on the role his powerful senior advisor, Karl Rove, may have played in revealing the identity of undercover operative Valerie Plame until a federal criminal investigator has finished his work. Bush made his comments with Karl Rove sitting behind him.
Can I ask you if you have spoken with your deputy chief of staff, Karl Rove, about the Valerie Plame matter, and do you think he acted improperly in talking about it with reporters?
Mark, I have instructed every member of my staff to fully cooperate in this investigation. I also will not prejudge the investigation based on media reports. We're in the midst of an ongoing investigation, and I will be more than happy to comment further once the investigation is completed. Elaine.
Mr. President, on that front note, has Mr. Rove come to you and discussed, when did he discuss the fact that he had conversations with reporters about Valerie Plame? And based on that, do you feel as though it was appropriate in 2003 for your spokesman to say definitively that Karl Rove had nothing to do with the Valerie Plame?
Elaine, we're in the midst of an ongoing investigation. And this is a serious investigation. And it is very important for people not to prejudge the investigation based on media reports. And again, I will be more than happy to comment on this matter once the investigation is complete.
President Bush being questioned by reporters yesterday. All of the Democrats on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence have called on President Bush to revoke Rove's security clearances and access to classified information. In a letter to the president, all nine Democrats on the committee urged him to take immediate action. Massachusetts Democrat John Tierney said, quote, "It's outrageous that even though Mr. Rove has acknowledged through his attorney that he disclosed the identity of a covert intelligence officer, he continues to have access to our nation's highest level of classified intelligence." Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee Chair, Ken Mailman, has been circulating pages of so-called talking points on the scandal that focus on attempting to discredit Ambassador Joe Wilson, the husband of the outed CIA operative. The talking points instruct GOP operatives to attack Wilson's credibility and his fact-finding mission to Niger, in which Wilson found there was no evidence Iraq had attempted to import uranium from the African nation. Wilson has long charged his wife was outed in retaliation for his debunking one of the administration's key justifications for the invasion of Iraq. Following Mailman's cue, Republican Congressmember Peter King of New York said on MSNBC's Scarborough program, quote, "Joe Wilson has no right to complain. And I think people like Tim Russert and the others who gave this guy such a free ride in all the media, they're the ones to be shot. Not Karl Rove. Listen, maybe Karl Rove was not perfect," King said. "We live in an imperfect world, and I give him credit for having the guts." Again, those are the words of New York Republican Congressmember Peter King. An Islamic scholar has been sentenced to life in prison in the U.S. for urging Muslims to join the Taliban in Afghanistan and fight U.S. troops after the 9/11 attacks. Ali al-Tamimi was convicted by a court in Alexandria, Virginia, in April. The 41-year-old cleric says he's innocent, and his lawyers have described the case as an attack on free speech and religious freedom. Defense lawyers argued that al-Tamimi only told young Muslims that they might be better off leaving the country because it would be difficult to practice their faith in the U.S. Before his sentencing Wednesday, al-Tamimi said, quote, "I will not admit guilt nor seek the court's mercy. I do this simply because I am innocent," he said. Bernard Ebbers, the creator of the telecommunications giant WorldCom, was sentenced to 25 years in prison Wednesday for his role in the fraud that led to the company's collapse. The $11 billion fraud resulted in the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history. The judge in the case rejected the defense's contention that Ebbers was not a mastermind of the accounting fraud. She said Ebbers was, quote, "clearly a leader of criminal activity in this case." When the company went bankrupt, more than 20,000 workers lost their jobs and shareholders lost about $180 billion. Ebbers is the first of six former WorldCom executives and accountants to face sentencing this summer. Military investigators examining alleged abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo prison camp say they found no evidence that there was torture or that senior leaders imposed faulty interrogation policies. But they also documented treatments such as leashing a terror suspect and forcing him to behave like a dog. A few individual interrogators and military personnel are facing punishment, but a recommendation by investigators to sanction the former prison commander was overruled by a senior general. But reports are now emerging that that commander is linked to the abuse at both Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. The Washington Post reports months before the world learned of the abuse and torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, interrogators at Guantanamo forced a prisoner to wear women's underwear on his head, confronted him with snarling military working dogs, and attached a leash to his chains. The paper cites the newly released military investigation. The techniques were approved by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld for use in interrogating Mohammed Khatami, the alleged 20th 9/11 hijacker, as part of a special interrogation plan aimed at breaking down the silent detainee. The Post says the report's findings are the strongest indication yet that the abuse seen in photographs at Abu Ghraib were not the invention of a small group of thrill-seeking military police officers. The report shows they were used several months before the United States invaded Iraq. The investigation also supports the idea that soldiers believe that placing hoods on detainees, forcing them to appear nude in front of women, and sexually humiliating them were approved interrogation techniques for use on detainees. A central figure in the investigation, Major General Jeffrey Miller, commanded the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and later helped set up U.S. operations at Abu Ghraib. Miller traveled to Iraq in September 2003 to assist in Abu Ghraib's startup, and he later sent in tiger teams of Guantanamo Bay interrogators and analysts as advisors and trainers. Within weeks of his departure from Abu Ghraib, military dogs were being used in interrogations, and naked detainees were humiliated and abused by military police soldiers working the night shift. Miller would have been the highest-ranking officer to face discipline for detainee abuses so far, but General Vance Craddock, head of the U.S. Southern Command, declined to follow the recommendation. The chief judge of Iraq's special tribunal announced Wednesday Saddam Hussein could go on trial as early as next month for his alleged role in a massacre 23 years ago. The judge said he could face the death penalty. Four other former Iraq officials could stand trial in the case in which Saddam's security agents allegedly shot dead at least 50 people after a plot to assassinate him was uncovered. Iraqi officials have announced the imminent start of Saddam's trial before, only to have the proceedings delayed. His lawyers say they have not been allowed to see any of the evidence against Saddam and charge they are being denied access to their client. And the Supreme Court's Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, was taken by ambulance to a Virginia hospital last night for observation and tests after complaining of a fever. Word of Rehnquist's hospitalization came after court security personnel went to his Arlington home on two occasions Wednesday. Officers were observed taking clothes, shoes, and Rehnquist's cane from the residence before driving off. There's mounting speculation he could step down at any moment. Velvet Underground here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Millions of people across Europe are observing a two-minute silence today to remember the victims of last week's London bombings. At least 52 people were killed, 700 injured in the blast. But few people remember that just 3 days after the bombings last Thursday, a series of suicide attacks in Iraq left 48 people dead, an eerily similar death toll to London. And the difference in the world's reaction was tangible. The Iraq attacks did not make it to the front pages of newspapers across the globe. Government sentiment around the world did not universally condemn the attacks, the victims received few words of consolation. Since last week, dozens more people have been killed in Iraq. Yesterday, a massive car bombing in Baghdad killed 27 people, almost all children. An American soldier was also killed in the blast. Elsewhere in Baghdad, another dozen Sunni Muslims were found dead after being arrested by Iraqi police over the weekend. Meanwhile, a new study from an Iraqi humanitarian organization is estimating 128,000 Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded in March 2003, over half of them women and children. And Iraq's Interior Ministry told the New York Times today over 8,000 civilians have been killed in insurgent attacks between August and May. We're joined right now by independent journalist Dar Jamal, who spent many months in Iraq. He's just returned from the World Tribunal on Iraq in Turkey. He also attended the alternative G8 meeting in Scotland. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
First, your response to the London bombings.
Well, just like anyone else, it's a horrific situation where anytime civilians, innocent civilians, are killed as a result of the actions of their government abroad, which is exactly what this is. It's a smaller scale 9/11 for Great Britain, where their government policy in Iraq specifically is most likely the cause of this blowback that occurs on their home soil where civilians are going to be killed. But just like anyone else, I condemn it. It's a horrific situation and awful to see this sort of thing where innocent civilians are paying the price for their government's actions.
So this comparison, the day after the attacks, looking at the tally, almost the same for the number of people counted that day killed in London and in Iraq, and yet the difference in the coverage.
It's astounding, but not surprising. At least the media is being consistent in their constant efforts to really not give the proper coverage to Iraq that it deserves. The situation in London, four bombs, and so many civilians killed, that's become almost an average day in Iraq. And yet we look at the disparity of the coverage, which this incident is really telling in the disparity that's ongoing with this, where so many civilians every single day in Iraq are being killed, the infrastructure in shambles, the country on fire, and where is the coverage? It's becoming more and more difficult as time goes on to even find it.
Dar Jamal, you did a report, Iraqi Hospitals Ailing Under Occupation. You presented it at the World Tribunal on Iraq in Istanbul. Talk about your findings.
Well, in this report, I surveyed 13 different hospitals in Iraq, mostly in Baghdad, but some to the north and some to the south. And I presented this as evidence at the World Tribunal, and it was the brunt of my testimony, where, in summation, the report really showed that hospitals now, a little over 2 years into the occupation, are suffering far worse than they were even under the sanctions against Iraq. The most common quote that I heard from doctors when I was working on this report is that our situation now is worse than it was even during the sanctions. In some disastrous levels of medicine shortages, equipment shortages, supply shortages, and almost no reconstruction happening. And also another one of the major findings was what appears to be now a standard operating procedure in the military of a deliberate targeting of hospitals, ambulances, and medical workers.
You have a section of your report on U.S. military interfering with medical care.
Right. And what I use as one of the major examples of that is the U.S. military operations, both sieges of Fallujah, that is, where particularly the November siege, the first thing that the U.S. military did was go into Fallujah General Hospital and occupy it, place snipers on the roof and detain doctors, prevent them from carrying out their medical care, as well as the deliberate targeting of ambulances. And since that siege, in ongoing operations like in Al-Qaim and in Haditha, we've seen an almost exact repeat of that, where hospitals are sealed off, medical workers are prevented from working or being targeted themselves. And this has become clear that not only in Al-Qaim and Haditha, but it's ongoing right now in Burez, which is right near Bakuba. As we speak, this is ongoing. And any time there is a major operation now by the U.S. military in Iraq, this is the type of tactic that they're using.
You spent a long time in Iraq. Did you talk to anyone in the U.S. military about this?
Well, phone calls to request information from them about what's been happening regarding the hospitals usually result in the typical runaround of, well, you need to contact this commander, we don't have information on this, or flat-out denials like, no, the U.S. military engages in no such policies. So it's been very difficult to get any accurate information or certainly admittance from them that this is happening. And most of my information on this is gleaned from medical workers themselves who have been targeted, detained, and threatened by the U.S. military.
Key to medical care, among other issues, is water, electricity. What is the situation in Iraq?
Well, again, the fact that the infrastructure, particularly the water and electricity, has had disastrous effects on hospitals. Just to give you an idea of how this plays out, when we have on average of 3 hours of electricity per day in Baghdad, most of the hospitals are relying almost solely on generators. And there was one incident that I cited in the report where in one of the larger hospitals in Baghdad, their generator broke down during the middle of the day, and an operation was in progress. So, of course, with a patient on the table, they were unable to run the instruments that they needed, and they lost a patient simply because of an electricity failure. And then, of course, with the water situation, almost as disastrous effects as well, where without potable water, sterilization becomes next to impossible. So we have rampant infections and inability for doctors to clean their instruments.
You know, Dr. Jamal, there's been this discussion in this country, should U.S. troops withdraw? What will happen in Iraq if they were to stay there? What else can the U.S. do? How often do you see issues raised of provide money for health care, for the infrastructure, compared to how much money is now being spent on the military?
Well, exactly. It's a grossly overlooked topic. The Ministry of Health was due to receive $1 billion of the reconstruction funds, and where has that money gone? Corruption is rampant, but a larger question for the United States government is what has happened to the companies that were awarded the contracts for the rebuilding, such as ABT and other companies handed out the contracts from USAID. There's almost no oversight going on. Where is the reconstruction that they have said they have completed? The hospitals have received basically paint jobs and sometimes new furniture, but as far as equipment and supplies that they've needed and medicines, it's just not there.
Well, what about the subcontracts for all of this? You talked to the Deputy Minister of Health, Dr. Amer Al-Khuzai.
Right. And that's exactly what he said, was that he had, at the time that I interviewed him, had put in constant requests to the Coalition Provisional Authority for monies, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars that they were asking for in order to get new supplies and give hospitals the equipment that they needed to get the work done. And he said that they had received basically only promises at that point. And since then, it appears as though that really no other assistance has come through, and any that has been dissolved into the corrupt situation with looting still going on, and many people inside the Ministry of Health itself being responsible for this not happening. But really, primarily, we see tens of millions of dollars being funneled into these Western companies. And I think the big question at the end of the day is, why are they not doing the work? If they can't do the work, why are they not giving these contracts to Iraqi companies?
Are there Iraqi companies, subcontractors, who could handle this?
Without a doubt. This is another situation where, for example, after the 91 Gulf War, where the infrastructure suffered so much damage, Iraq is more than capable itself of providing the people as well as the knowledge and the experience necessary to get the job done, and they're simply not being allowed to. Of all of the contracts handed out in Iraq since the invasion, roughly 2% of the value of all of the money available for reconstruction have gone to Iraqi concerns. So it's the same in the medical situation.
We're talking to independent journalist Dar Jamal. We'll go to break. When we come back, I just want to ask you quickly about the brain drain in Iraq and also about Zarqawi. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we continue our conversation with independent journalist Dar Jamal, he has done a report, spent many months in Iraq, called Iraqi Hospitals Ailing Under Occupation. We know about the Geneva Conventions supposed to protect prisoners, prisoners of war. You include sections of the Geneva Conventions relevant to health care and health rights. Can you talk about those?
Well, in summation, essentially, the Geneva Conventions that have been broken cover things regarding to the health sector, like it's the primary responsibility of the occupying powers to ensure the safety of civilians. And these are broken repeatedly by not just with civilians, but medical workers as well. Again, not just not protecting them, but deliberately targeting medical workers, impeding them from doing their work. For example, at the lead of the report, I have a photograph of which was shown actually in media all around the globe at the beginning of the siege of Fallujah, of doctors literally inside a hospital being detained, being handcuffed, being prevented from doing their work. And this is a nice photograph of a violation of international law. So this is one, as well as not assisting them in any way, shape, or form when it's obvious that the medical system needs the help.
Zarqawi, you've written about Zarqawi. You were in Jordan asking people about him, a top aide, apparently. The U.S. reports has been captured in Iraq.
Well, when I was in Amman, I went to Al-Zarqa, which is the city where Zarqawi is from. It's close to Amman, and I interviewed people there, and I went and saw where his brother lives and brother-in-law lives in a couple of the different mosques where he used to pray. And really, it's a difficult story to follow. What I found was that he definitely has existed as an individual, but there remains no definitive proof whatsoever that he's still alive, and certainly none that has been made available by the U.S. military that this man is operating in Iraq. He remains a large, nebulous myth, much like bin Laden.
Finally, the brain drain in Iraq.
Again, this is a direct result of the bloody occupation, and we have so many Iraqi doctors who have been leaving the country because of the security situation, and primarily because they've been targeted for kidnappings in order for the criminal gangs to extort ransom from their families. So there is massive brain drain, and this is another huge difficulty facing the hospitals in Iraq, where there's just simply not enough doctors.
Dar Jamal, I want to thank you for joining us today. His report is Iraqi Hospitals Ailing Under Occupation. If people want to get a copy of it, where can they go online?
They can go to my website and download a copy there.
And that is?
It's darjamaliraq.com. It's darjamailiraq.com.
And if you have trouble remembering that, just go to our website at democracynow.org. By the way, we are podcasting there. Transcripts of today's interviews are there, as well as video and audio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and we're on both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, we're on Channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, we're on Channel 375 twice a day on Link TV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org. We are now podcasting, and you can tell your friends about that, where you can download the MP3. We have our headlines in Spanish, translated there in audio as well as transcript, and we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. As we continue our broadcast today, President Bush has called the unauthorized groups patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border, quote, vigilantes. But California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger praised the so-called Minutemen, and Texas Governor Rick Perry refused a proposal by Democratic state lawmakers to block the Minutemen from operating in Texas. Roughly 700,000 undocumented migrants enter the United States annually and remain here. A recent RAND Corporation study found that immigrants to the United States inject about $10 billion a year into the economy. But the latest anti-immigrant backlash is latching on to the war on terrorism to renew a call for increased policing of the border. Arizona Senator John McCain has supported limited amnesty for undocumented migrants already in the country. In addition to increased border security, his bipartisan immigration reform bill would increase money for the Border Patrol. McCain spoke Wednesday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Mr. President, a dangerous state of lawlessness exists along the southwestern border, and it's becoming increasingly volatile. The federal government's inability to stem the illegal traffic flowing across the border has shifted substantial financial and social burdens to residents of the border region. Recent action by Minutemen along the Arizona border provided the nation with an image of the frustration felt by many Americans. Border states are suffering from the immediate and downstream problems associated with illegal immigration. Our hospitals are burdened with enormous uncompensated costs, and so are our state and local law enforcement agencies. We simply need more manpower to protect the border in the near term. I strongly believe that once we fix our broken immigration system, we will see the day that some of our border resources can be safely shifted to other priorities. Until then, Congress must have the will to take the action needed to reform our broken immigration system. We need to have a robust Border Patrol force hired, trained, and on the job. While providing solid resources to state and local officials to ensure the readiness of our first responders is imperative, the men and women serving in the Border Patrol are literally on the front lines in the fight to keep the terrorists out of our country.
Senator McCain Wednesday. Legislators in the Congressional Immigration Reform Caucus, led by Colorado Republican Tom Tancredo, also raised the threat of terrorism as a justification for more security at the border. But they oppose any amnesty plan, and Tancredo's opposition to any guest worker program puts him at odds with agribusiness and most of the Republican Party. A growing strain of anti-immigrant sentiment on Capitol Hill uses cultural arguments against immigration that draw on previous measures like Proposition 187 in California, which would have denied basic services to undocumented residents, and English-only initiatives around the country. Well, we're joined today by a number of people in the country to talk about this issue. We start in our Washington studio with journalist Michael Shearer, and has an article in the July-August edition of Mother Jones magazine on the Minutemen operating in Arizona, and Congressmember Tancredo's immigration reform proposals in Washington. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. You have a piece called Scrimmage on the Border, Vigilantes and Camera Crews Amassing in the Arizona Desert, but the real standoff is in Washington as fear of immigration invades the halls of Congress. What's happening there?
On the border, you have what Senator McCain just described, really a situation that is unexcusable from a humanitarian perspective. Hundreds of people are dying every year in the desert. Thousands of people a day are being forced to walk 10, 20 miles through a rather hazardous desert just to get jobs that President Vicente Fox in Mexico says they should be able to get, that American business says they should be able to get, that the President of the United States, George Bush, says Americans don't want. And in response, you have groups like the Minutemen, which are essentially retired white people, largely, who have decided to play soldier on the border. They've largely conducted themselves recently with this media exposure well. They haven't engaged the immigrants, but what they the precedent they represent is hazardous, and there have been groups that have been actual vigilantes on the border detaining people. There have been allegations of people being beaten up when they've been detained by Border Patrol people. And so you have what really is a dangerous situation that Congress hopefully will deal with in a realistic way.
Well, I want to ask you about some of those proposals in a minute, but I want to go to the border right now. The summer heat can be lethal for people trying to cross into the United States. An Arizona human rights group records the border deaths for May and June at 57 people. Two aid workers were arrested on the Arizona border last weekend. Members of the Stop the Deaths Coalition were detained by Border Patrol agents while they were driving severely dehydrated migrants to a hospital. Daniel Strauss and Shanti Seltz were charged with obstruction of justice and aiding and abetting illegal immigrants in furtherance of their illegal residence in the country. We're joined on the phone from Tucson by Shanti Seltz, who was just arrested. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy.
I first learned about No More Deaths last year, the organization, when I was speaking in Colorado Springs, and some of the students there had used their vacation to go to the border to join your organization, to help migrants in the desert, to get them water, to help them to deal with their medical conditions. Can you talk about what happened to you and why you were on the border?
I spent about 6 months living on the border last year and was very unaware of the conditions down here. And after just living here, it's hard to miss. It's right in your face. And after seeing water bottles in the arroyo behind my house and witnessing people walking down the road, I was called to learn more about what's happening and got involved with No More Deaths and started working in the camp last year and then came back this year to do another summer of work.
So tell us what happened. How'd you get arrested?
Due to the criminal context of this investigation, we are unable by a lawyer to talk about the actual events of the day, but I can talk about what our organization does and what our protocol is. We give humanitarian aid in the form of food, water, and medical assistance in the field to migrants who are crossing the desert on foot. Like you said, the conditions are extremely treacherous as far as temperatures. I mean, it's been over 100 degrees for over a month in the Arizona desert now. So, and people are walking. They are pushed very hard in the night by their groups, moving very fast. And a lot of people we encounter have gone 2-3 days without any food or water. If they do find water, a lot of times they're drinking out of cattle tanks, brown water with green algae growing in it. Some people have stomach infections. They've been throwing up. They've had horrible diarrhea just from the conditions of walking in that intense heat for hours and days is extreme. And so, and the blisters on people's feet, too, is amazing just from the heat and from walking all day. And so we give medical treatment in the field, and we give food and water. And in emergency situations, in our protocol, we can medically evacuate people to area hospitals or medical facilities. And we have done that, and we'll continue to do that.
Why can't you talk about your own case?
Just because it's in the midst of it all right now, and we're just in the beginning stages of how we're going to handle it and what's coming before us.
We're talking to Shanti Seltz of No More Deaths, the organization. The question of who polices the U.S.-Mexico border has gained national attention through the activities of the Minutemen throughout the Southwest. Border Patrol officials in Arizona say the Minutemen and groups like them should not take on the role of professional law enforcement. There are dangers that the self-proclaimed patrols could trip sensors, disturb drag lines, interfere with the normal operations of border control agents. Minuteman Jim Gilchrist says the group is, quote, there to assist law enforcement. In Yuma, Arizona, a group called the Yuma Patriots formed recently and now includes about 40 people who patrol small sections of the border unarmed and call the Border Patrol when they sight border crossers. Part of the border in Yuma is contained within the Cocopa Indian Reservation. The Patriots initially attempted to operate within the reservation, but the tribal council says it doesn't recognize the Yuma Patriots because they're not an authorized extension of the Border Patrol. Now the group engages in its activities outside the reservation boundaries. We're joined on the phone by Flash Sharar, founder of Yuma Patriots. We're also joined by Jose Matus with the Arizona Border Rights Project, which works to protect indigenous people's rights to cross the border. Flash Sharar, can you talk about your organization, the Yuma Patriots, and what you're doing?
Sure. We're similar to the Minutemen, but, you know, we're very tired of people dying in our deserts. We're tired of the medical expenses. We're tired of the systems, and we're tired of the immigration system that is failing the American people and the Mexican people. The problem, and what most of the public doesn't understand, is what is actually happening here. You have coyotes that are killing these people, rushing them at night. These people are going without food, without water. America is under siege, not only by the Mexican people, but by terrorist groups. If America thinks that 9/11 was just a pastime, it's going to happen again, and they're going to come through the southern borders of America. We do not have enough border patrol. Our government doesn't seem to care. The president doesn't care at all, because if he did, we would be protecting the American borders, not Syrian borders. Our boys need to come out of Iraq, come back to America, and protect our borders. There's people dying. There's diseases that were eradicated 40 years ago that are back. You're talking polio. You're talking leprosy. You're talking whooping cough, tuberculosis at a rapid rate. In our own hospital, we have cases of these not being reported to the news because they don't want the American public alerted about it. The death toll on the border, right now in the last month, we've had 9 people die. We've had a robbery in our town that killed 6 people. We have had, 6 months ago, we had a young man killed at a gas station because an illegal alien took his vehicle. My son was robbed at gunpoint, is what started all of this. America needs to stand up, protect its borders, and protect the Mexican people, because they're being used. The Mexican people are being used, and it is terrible. It's an atrocity.
Jose Matus is also with us with the Arizona Border Rights Project. Your response?
Well, my response to that is that there's a lot of misinformation. There are no doubt people crossing the border that are with criminal intent, but the majority of the people coming through are seeking a better life and survival for themselves and their families. But the issue also is placed on economic policies that have historically dictated immigration policies and enforcement. The repulsive attraction of migrants' labor is a reality of American workforce. And the approach that these groups, civilian groups in the border area are promoting is something that they should really look at the economic policies that the United States have been created and that have displaced other workers in third world countries, and that is one of the big reasons why a lot of these people are coming across. NAFTA, for example, that was the reason the uprising of the Zapatistas, because of the loss of some of their land and displacement of a lot of the indigenous farmers in Mexico. And that is one of the things that the immigration policies have demonstrated over the past 10 years with Operation Gatekeeper in San Diego, Hold the Line in El Paso, Safeguard in Arizona. It has not worked. It has failed. And the continued strategy of building more walls in the southern border will create even more and more problems for border crossers, and also give economic opportunity to the coyotes and other polleros that are well organized now because of border policies and bringing in individuals from third world countries.
Flasher.
Well, you know, the problem is you have to come into this country correctly. And by doing so, you can get a job, you can get the proper documentation. The problem is we are allowing illegal immigration, and that's why these people are dying. This America was based on immigration, but there was a way to do it. The worst part of it is our own government is allowing this policy to fail, and that's why these folks are being harmed. We looked at some percentages. In every group, that is trying to get across any border, it's 10% that are violent, 90% that are not. We have migrant workers in our town, and we need these workers. We need these workers to pick our fields, the lettuce. We supply 85% of the lettuce during the winter for the entire United States.
Now, let me put that number to Jose Matus. 90% violent?
Hello?
Jose Matus?
Yes.
90% violent?
No. 10% violent.
10% violent, 90% not.
Harmless.
Jose Matus.
That could be correct. However, going back to people coming in legally, the system needs to be looked at in acquiring a visa because it's very difficult. You're talking about $30 for a Mexican passport and then an additional $100 for an American visa. And an American visa is very difficult to obtain because of the requirements to obtain a visa, which goes from having 2,500 pesos in the bank, ensuring that they're not going to abandon their country. They need to have all kinds of documents that are necessary to obtain a visa, and thus, if they spend the $100 fee, the chances of them getting that visa is very limited because depending on the process or the official at the American consulate, they may deny an individual a passport. On top of that, if one applies for a work visa, that's one that is an additional cost, as well as they need to make sure that a company that is going to hire them has a position that no one here in the United States qualifies for.
I want to end with Michael Scherer, the Washington correspondent for Mother Jones, who wrote Scrimmage on the Border about Prop 200 in Arizona, the legislation, and how it is seen in Washington. Very controversial legislation that was opposed by the senators of Arizona.
There are a number of proposals right now in Congress for how to deal with this problem, and they range from punitive measures, which I would categorize Prop 200 as being, that's a proposition that denies government services to people who are in Arizona illegally, to measures that try and make legal those who are illegal in the United States and those who are here to work and are here to help their families back home and to start families in the United States. And this debate, while everyone agrees there's a problem here, there's wide disagreement on how to solve it. And that's going to be the issue coming up. And one of the issues that comes up with this is the question of, you know, what America is and will become. Are we going to continue to be a nation of immigrants? Are we going to continue to invite millions of people, as we have throughout our history, to come to our country and to integrate themselves into the country and change the country as they arrive? Or are we going to say, stop, you know, we've filled up, we're going to just allow a trickle now. If you want to come work, you're not going to become citizens. You're just going to work for a few months, and then we're going to send you back to your home country.
On that note,
that's what we're going to have happening in Congress.
I want to thank you, Michael Scherer of Mother Jones, Scrimmage on the Border, your piece, as well as Jose Matus of the Arizona Border Rights Project, and Flash Scherer, founder of the Yuma Patriots on the Border in Arizona. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, it's the 20th anniversary of the blowing up of the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, in a New Zealand harbor. Now, new documents show that the French president, Jean-François Mitterrand, ordered the blowing up of this ship. One man died. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 20 years ago, the Green Peace flagship Rainbow Warrior was bombed by the French government and sunk in a harbor in Auckland, New Zealand. The ship was preparing to head to sea to protest French nuclear bomb tests in the South Pacific. Greenpeace photographer Fernando Pereira was killed in the attack. Last weekend, the French newspaper Le Monde revealed the late French president, François Mitterrand, personally approved the sinking of the ship. The paper obtained a handwritten account of the operation written by the former head of France's spy agency, Steve Lacoste. He describes his meeting with Mitterrand 2 months before the attack. At that meeting, he asked Mitterrand for permission to conduct the bombing. Lacoste wrote, Mitterrand, quote, gave me his consent while emphasizing the importance he placed on the nuclear tests. Two members of the 13-person French Secret Service team that carried out the bombing were arrested 2 days later. Dominique Prier and Alain Marfart were sentenced to 10 years in prison, but were extradited to French Polynesia, where they served less than three. Others who carried out the bombing have apparently escaped punishment. The man who coordinated the operation, Louis-Pierre Dillet, a former lieutenant colonel in the French Secret Service, is now living in Washington, D.C., and working for the giant Belgian arms maker FH Herstal. The company sells weapons to the United States Special Forces and to New Zealand's Defense Forces. We're joined on the phone now from New Zealand by David Roby, independent journalist who was on board the ship on its last journey and wrote Eyes of Fire, The Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior. A new updated edition of the book is being released this week. He's also an associate professor in Auckland University of Technology School of Communication Studies. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, David Roby.
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you respond to this latest news, the handwritten memo that describes the approval of the French President François Mitterrand for the blowing up of the ship?
Well, it's been largely received in New Zealand with a sort of a certain amount of ho-hum. Well, we thought so all along. Most of the reaction, certainly in New Zealand, is that, well, you know, it was no surprise. You know, people have more or less accepted for the best part of 20 years that although it was not, you know, absolutely certain before that Mitterrand had actually sort of authorized the attack, it's been more or less accepted in New Zealand that that was probably the case. It's just interesting that Sir Geoffrey Palmer, who was the Deputy Prime Minister in New Zealand at the time of the bombing, said his reaction when confronted with this news from Le Monde, he said it's very disappointing that because one would not expect the President of a friendly nation to authorize an illegal act against the nation with whom you enjoy friendly relations and with whom you've fought in two world wars. That seems to me to be rather extraordinary. So that was Sir Geoffrey Palmer's reaction.
This past weekend, there was this memorial at the Rainbow Warrior. Can you talk about what happened, who was there, and also about the Greenpeace photographer who was killed?
Well, Fernando, he, in fact, had a cabin just very close. I was on board for something like 10 weeks up until the time of the bombing, but I'd actually left a couple of nights before because after the Rainbow Warrior arrived in New Zealand, my home is actually in Auckland, so I'd actually gone ashore. It's good to get ashore for a while. With the 20th anniversary, Morel, Fernando's daughter, who was 8 at the time, that he died. She came out for the voyage of the new Rainbow Warrior going up to Matari Bay, where the original ship was sunk to make a living reef. Well, Fernando's daughter, Morel, came up on this voyage, and it was a very emotional time for her. It was an opportunity to talk to crew members. And also she addressed the local Māori iwi, the tribe, and the Greenpeace people and many other peace supporters and so on that came up for the ceremony.
The mission of the Rainbow Warrior, can you talk about that and how it applies to what is happening today, David Roby?
Well, I mean, the irony today, I think, is that, you know, 20 years ago, this was an act of state terrorism. Yet the major powers of the era, the US, Britain, and so on, and even Australia, gave no reaction whatsoever to this extraordinary attack, you know, on a sovereign nation, a friendly sovereign nation, with 13 agents operating in the country as part of the attack. And in this context of war on terror today, it just seems extraordinary that so little attention was given to that, and the legacy of the period of nuclear testing, although France subsequently stopped nuclear testing in 1996 when it signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, there's still the unresolved problem of the Tahitians that were subjected to radioactive fallout during the period of atmospheric testing in French Polynesia. And another aspect, of course, with the Rainbow Warrior was that immediately prior to being bombed, it was actually on a voyage to the Marshall Islands, where it resettled a number of Rongelap Islanders. In fact, the whole community on Rongelap Atoll were moved to another island. And the reason they did this was because they were subjected to nuclear radiation during the 1950s when the United States was doing atmospheric testing in the Marshall Islands.
We're talking to David Robey, who was on the last journey of the Eyes of Fire before it was blown up by the French government, by French intelligence agents. Do you think President François Mitterrand should be charged for the explosion and for the death of the photographer?
Well, the fact is that you know, there's a lot of bitter sort of feeling left in New Zealand as a result of the fact that only two of those agents were arrested, and of course they were sentenced to 10 years for manslaughter for the death of Fernando Pereira, and also for willful damage to the Greenpeace ship. And of course, what really happened was through a brokered trade deal and mediation from the United Nations at the time, France did apologize and it did pay over $13 million in compensation to the New Zealand government. But in return, New Zealand handed over these two agents to the French authorities, and they were whisked off to Howe Atoll in French Polynesia, which was the military base supporting the nuclear testing at Mururoa. Well, of course, Howe Atoll was rather something like a military club med, and both Alain Maffar and Dominique Pierre only served there in exile for probably less than 2 years.
David Robey, we have to wrap up.
To France's heroes.
But I we have to wrap up, and of course, with Mitterrand dead, I mean members of his administration, but also the head of French intelligence, Louis-Pierre Dillet, the former lieutenant colonel in French Secret Service, now living in Washington and working for the giant Belgian arms maker FH Airstal. It's interesting. He's selling weapons to, well, your own Defense Department, to the New Zealand Defense Department, as
absolutely,
well as
and many
to the United States.
Are quite aghast at that.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, David Robey, author of Eyes of Fire on the Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Yoruba Richin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.